ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, happy Friday. Selena Green here to wrap up another week of The Country Hour for you. Now, have you heard the news that Victoria has stopped all culling of wild dogs and dingoes in an area of that state along the South Australian border? Well, Victorian farmers are, fair to say, pretty unhappy about the move overall.
Unfortunately, no consultation, nothing. You know, the reality is that next week there's meant to be a gathering of, you know, like-minded people to discuss the issue of the unprotection of the dingo. The government's just gone now and made this decision in regard to the West, and just totally, yeah, ridiculous. Just no, as I said before, no consultation.
More on that to come. Do you have concerns about what it could mean for producers here in South Australia? I'll speak with Livestock SA in a moment, but also keen to hear your thoughts today on the talkback number 1300 222 891, or the text line 0467 922 891. Also coming up, time to take a look at what nutrition and other factors you should be thinking about before lambing season. But yes, first, over the border, the Victorian government has lifted an order that enabled farmers in the northwest of that state to protect their livestock from dingoes. It means, as of now, dingoes or wild dogs are not permitted to be culled on private or public land. And the government says it took this step because dingoes are at risk of extinction. The Victorian government have pledged to spend $550,000 on non-lethal control measures like exclusion fencing and guardian animals. But Victorian Farmers Federation Livestock Group Vice President Peter Starr told Angus Verley that he doesn't reckon that will go very far.
I would suggest to the government that they look at the example that's been done in Queensland, and, you know, the cost somewhere out there. I was out there 10 years ago with the National Wild Dog Group, and, you know, that cost of that fencing was somewhere in $8,500 to $10,000 a kilometre, you know. If the Victorian government wants to get serious about protecting dingoes, open your checkbook.
What's it going to mean for those livestock producers in the northwest who have wild dogs or dingoes killing their animals?
Well, they've just got to take the action to control these as coming back onto their own property. You know, will the fences work? You know, it's been proven in the northeast. Electric fencing, guardian animals, people do have them, but at the same time, they're more or less saying it doesn't do the full job. To be totally competent that our livestock are protected, we have to have the wild dog control measures working in the background on the public land. Well, guess what? In northwest Victoria, the actions on public land have been taken away.
Just explain what it's like to have animals killed by wild dogs or dingoes.
Oh, look, it is the most heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching thing to come upon, you know, to get up early in the morning, go out, check round your flock and just see lambs torn to pieces, ewes with their guts hanging out. It is not a pretty sight. You know, it is heartbreaking to have to live with this scenario of having to deal with wild dogs. The Victorian government has just made it harder. I'm very concerned that there is just people out there who will not listen to common sense. As I said, I think it's next Tuesday. There's a meeting of both sides of the wild dog argument somewhere here in Melbourne to discuss this issue, to ratify the science. You know, there's scientists that say, yes, they're purebred dingoes. There are other scientists that just say that this is a load of rubbish, that, you know, it's just pie in the sky. Probably not a hell of a lot we can do to push back. You know, I guess the plea is listen to common sense. Keep in mind that, you know, the livelihood and the mental stability of your farmers that are affected by wild dogs throughout this state is just an absolute joke, Angus.
Peter Starr from the Victorian Farmers Federation. Farmer Darren Smith runs sheep and cattle and grows crops at Patchy Wallach on the Victorian Mallee. His farm borders a national park and he often baits plus employs a trapper when there's a spate of dog attacks.
In the past, we've had some very bad losses. One particular area just south of Patchy Wallach where we joined the park there, we had a mob of 200 sheep we brought in, and over a course of 18 months, we lost between 60 and 70 of them. And nearly all the sheep you end up saving, they end up being cripples. Once a dog's bitten a sheep, it's pretty hard to get them back right again. But excluding fencing, it's going to have to be a bloody good fence. And then we've got trouble with kangaroos. They'll dig holes under it, so it'll be an ongoing job maintaining that fence.
As Victorian farmer Darren Smith, Mel Browning from the Australian Dingo Foundation has welcomed the Victorian government's decision, saying it's been a long time coming.
This is momentous for dingo protection. We are so delighted and we want to congratulate the Victorian government on this decision. After 236 years of relentless persecution of our native apex land predator, the dingo, to have a population that has had some serious protection put in place is extraordinary and heartwarming. And we hope that this is a step forward that's going to lead to further protections for other critically endangered remnant dingo populations around Australia and in the rest of Victoria.
That was Mel Browning from the Australian Dingo Foundation. Greg Mifsud is the National Wild Dog Management Coordinator with the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions. He says regardless of whether they're wild dogs or dingoes, animals killing livestock need to be controlled.
Oh, look, at the end of the day, whether they're dingoes or wild dogs, they still attack livestock. They've still got a significant amount of land within the Big Desert and Wiperfield National Park complex to undertake their ecological role if they've got one and behave as they want to.
So that debate around whether they're dingoes or wild dogs, to you, that's just semantics and it's not that meaningful?
It's all about managing impact. And at the end of the day, if animals are killing sheep or killing threatened wildlife, whether that's invasive or not, they need to be managed.
Greg Mifsud there from the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions, and that reporting from Angus Verley. Well, this decision by Victoria to stop culling wild dogs in the northwest of Victoria could have implications for producers along that border here in South Australia. Livestock SA says it's been seeking further information from South Australian authorities on what this all could mean. Travis Tobin is Livestock SA's CEO. I've got him on the line. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon, Selena.
I understand you had an opportunity to meet with PIRRSA this week. The issue of Victoria's decision around dingo management, was that something that you had a chance to discuss with them?
We did, yeah. And concerningly, what we've been discussing is a recent decision by the Victorian government to stop wild dog controls in the northwest of Victoria. And that's become effective from the 14th of March. So we're fairly concerned about that and we're trying to find out more information on it.
What is your concern around the potential impacts for producers along that border area, but what the potential implications of this could be of Victoria stopping that control in that area?
Well, I think there's a few issues that we're quite concerned about. I guess first and foremost, just the decision itself. So, you know, there's no engagement with other jurisdictions, despite repeated attempts from our government, as well as communities in border regions, and even within their own state of Victoria, there appears to have been no consultation, and there's definitely no consideration given to the impacts that it's going to have on other jurisdictions. So when you start to talk about those impacts, it's a border fence we've got that stretches all the way from the top of the Victorian border, so up in the Riverland area, all the way down to Bordertown. So it's about 250-kilometre shared fence. And the issues that will come from that decision, potentially, as buffer zones are removed, those sorts of things, is no doubt the impact on the sheep industry and producers themselves. So we know from experience here in South Australia that is significant on both fronts. So when we talk about prior to the investments we've made here in rebuilding the dog fence across the north of the state, in 2018-19, South Australian livestock producers were losing about 20,000 sheep annually to wild dogs, so that's a direct cost of around $4 million. But perhaps more importantly, and how do you actually quantify the real cost of this, are the indirect impacts and the social impacts. So they're the psychological trauma, potentially the suicides. On a production level, you have plummeting lambing percentages, things like that, playing on producers' minds all the time, what's happening out there, because we know, these dogs kill for sport, not just to consume meat, and that was devastating in 2018 in our state. So Now, that's why the actions were taken here, to rebuild the dog fence, and that's a considerable investment, which is a co-investment between federal government, state government and industry of, you know, $26 million to rebuild that fence across the north and put those controls in place since 2018. So on a number of levels, yeah, you could say we're pretty concerned at this stage.
Have you had any indication from the government or from PRRSA as to whether they're having a rethink about the way these wild dogs or dingoes are managed here in South Australia following Victoria's decision?
There's no change to the way wild dogs are managed in South Australia, and we don't understand there's an intention to change that at all. And we know that's been effective. So, you know, since 2018, in concert with the rebuilding of the fence, we've seen aerial baiting, ground baiting programs, professional trapper programs, workshops. We've seen some training, and that's driven wild dog populations here to historic lows. And the benefits of all that result in restocking of sheep, and for our state, that's enabled about 18,000 square kilometres of pastoral land to be restocked with sheep. And that in turn returns millions of dollars to the economy. It provides greater employment, and that obviously benefits regional communities in South Australia.
What are you wanting to hear from the government on our side? Will this require perhaps some extra monitoring or perhaps even further investment to keep these populations from, I guess, coming out of Victoria into South Australia?
That's what we don't know yet, and we're trying to find out some more information. So, yes, if they're stopping all wild dog controls in the northwest of Victoria, we've got to assess what impacts will that have on South Australia. I think at this stage there also needs to be some government-to-government discussions. And as I said earlier, it is concerning that we're seeing jurisdictional decisions being made independent of any other consultation when it does have impacts on neighbouring states. So it appears they were not learnt much from the COVID period, which wasn't that long ago, where you can't make some of these decisions in isolation when your decisions are going to have severe impacts on others. So I think it's a bit of a watch and see, Selena. We do have concerns, and we are working with the government to work through this issue.
Travis Tobin, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Pleasure, Selena.
Travis Tobin, the CEO of Livestock SA. Later on in the program, you'll hear from the dingo researcher whose recent analysis played a key role in the Victorian government's decision, and she wants the laws to also change in South Australia, so stick around for that. Right now, it's 17 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, it is coming up towards lambing season, so what nutrition and other factors should producers consider in getting the best out of your ewes? Calcium requirements are a key mineral needed at lambing time, according to Emma Shaddock, who is a senior livestock production specialist. She's been working with producers on farming systems which ensure good ewe management.
In the nutrition space, there's still a lot of work getting done on how best we can regulate certainly calcium requirements, because they're massive. And sort of your number one mineral that you need at lambing time, but also in relation to things like magnesium and your vitamin D, so that will help make that whole picture work rather than just chasing one particular mineral. And then fitting that in with the wider system as well. So a nutrient that often gets forgotten is just energy in itself. And at lambing time, there's a really fine balance between getting enough energy into the system without overfeeding as well, which can cause problems.
What other factors should producers be considering at the moment?
There's lots of other, I guess, management tools that work around with the nutrition space as well. Certainly being able to scan for singles and multiples and then manage those mobs separately can make a big difference. Those multiples have a much higher, especially energy requirement, but probably even mineral requirement coming into lambing. And twin lamb survival in particular is a lot more challenging. So there's a lot more room there to manage those ewes better and get better lambing percentages on the ground, whether that's through mob size or shelter or different feeding rates. There's certainly a lot involved.
Tell us a little bit about your role and what kinds of programs you are running to help producers.
So I guess my role is quite diverse. I do a lot of one-on-one work with producers, targeting everything from pre-lambing plans and looking at boosting lamb survival rates through to setting up feedlots and containment yards and everything in between, worm control programs. So just whatever is the pinch point, I suppose, in someone's system that they want to improve on. We do a lot of set management plans for that, tailored to an individual producer. But I also work on a few of the nationally run programs too. By far and large, the most common and probably most successful one I've been a part of has been the Lifetime Ewe Management, which is a brilliant way, especially when we're talking managing ewes coming into lambing, to just piece together all of these different tools available and work out how they can fit on your farm. It's a program that's been running, goodness, for probably pushing nearly two decades now, but really tailored to an individual situation. It's a nice small group. There's lots of hands-on work. It's, yeah, a really great program to be a part of.
The Lifetime Ewe Management program, just what does it look like over the course of someone participating in it?
So you work in groups of 5 to 7 producers in your local area, and you meet up 6 times over 12 months. So you're following a mob of your choice through their reproductive cycle, essentially. So you can look at some of the implications of your management practices on their performance. So you learn a lot of condition scoring and how to use that as a tool, pasture assessments, and then all the management behind the scenes at each stage. But the beauty is that as well, at each session, you'll visit everybody's property. So you get to see a bit of what else is going on and bounce a few ideas around as well. So really brilliant course. Everyone's got that one thing that they're just not that comfortable with, or it's not quite working. And it is worth having a conversation to see how you might be able to improve on that, especially now with margins and everything like that getting tighter as well. So you want to make the most out of your system rather than just gone are the days where the sheep used to run in the back paddock and we forget they're there until we need to shear them. So there's certainly people seeing some really brilliant results. There's so many opportunities now to really fine-tune a system and make it work and fit with your bigger farming program as well.
Emma Shattuck there, who's a senior livestock production specialist with Elders, and she was speaking to Kate Higgins. Would you ever consider giving durum a go? Well, the Southern Australian Durum Growing Association says they're hoping more farmers may give the crop a grow, and they've been researching different aspects of making that happen. SAGDA recently held its Durum and Grains Forum in Padthaway, gathering growers from right across the region, and the chair, Ethan Vogelsang, said it was a good day out.
Essentially, it's a pre-seeding forum, just all the latest variety trials and advancements in the industry, along with some marketing and movements with global trends with pricing.
So, yes, Padthaway today and Balaclava a couple weeks ago. Are you happy with how durum's travelling in South Australia? Is there enough of it in the ground, according to you?
Well, we're just trying to push durum into areas that traditionally haven't been grown, south of probably Bordertown and Canaiva. Also, as you'd heard today, Dr. Hugh Woolworth is working on pushing it out back into the Murray Plains, where crown rot's been an issue, and obviously there's some movements with technology and varieties that hopefully will get it back into them places.
What do you think's holding more people back in the region from giving durum a go?
Oh, I think it's sort of not really been spoken about. Like getting awareness out has probably been more of a thing for us to put trials in areas that it hasn't been, and hopefully we can expand the industry from here on out.
How did you get into it?
I was looking for something different, and I believe I might have heard a radio report or something like that, and went to a forum like this, and away I went. So, yeah.
And last time our listeners would have heard from you, there was a bit of a durum seed shortage in the region. How did that end up going? Was that sorted out?
Yeah, we sorted that out probably by us putting a call out, initiated a lot of grower-to-grower contact, made sure your neighbour had enough seed, and we also were able to help out growers that were trying to get into the industry source seed.
As the chair of the Southern Australian Durum Growing Association, Ethan Vogelsang, and he was speaking there to Elsie Adamo.
Here's my top footy tip for the season. You can get your games live and ad-free on the ABC Listen app.
That's insightful.
I know, right? AFL, NRL, men's, women's. Whatever footy you're after, we've got you covered.
Kicks him on the line, he does, he bounces a throw.
Every goal, try, mark and tackle. Called by ABC Sports expert commentary team.
How did he do it? Game, set, bingo.
This season on the home of 100% pure footy, the ABC Listen app.
It's that time we head off to the Weather Bureau. Joining us again, our forecaster today is Jenny Horvat. Hello, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Selena.
What's the story as we round out the week?
Yeah, look, it's pretty similar to what it has been, and it's going to be pretty similar as we head into the weekend. So we've got our ridge of high pressure to the south of the state, maintaining that milder south-southeasterly airstream. And up north, we are starting to see a little bit of moisture coming in from the territory from ex-tropical cyclone Megan. Saw a little bit of rainfall in the last 24 hours up in the far north there, so up until 9 a.m. this morning. Only a couple of millimetres up near the border there at Tyon. And since 9 a.m. up around Pukacha Ernabella there, we've picked up just over a millimetre. So it is starting to make its way into the state. It's not going to come too far south and really just hover up there in the far north over the weekend. Maybe a little bit more likely up in that far north east corner today, once things start to moisten up a little bit there. Still a little bit dry up around the Moomba area, but it looks like things will start to moisten up and start to see some shower activity up through there, and possibly even tending to rain at times over the weekend up in that top corner of the state. Further south, saw some really cool temperatures there this morning, getting down to around 3 or 4 degrees in the southeast. Narracourt, minimum temperature there of around 3 degrees. Coonawarra around 4. A little bit warmer up in the north, up around Moomba under that cloud. Minimum temperature there of around 21 degrees. So a little bit of a mixed bag, and generally those minimum temperatures were below average for this time of year. As we head into the weekend, we're still maintaining that ridge of high pressure down the south. Again, looking at those southeasterly winds pushing through. Could see a little bit of cloud around some of those windward coasts. Couldn't rule out a little bit of light shower activity around pretty much southern coast tomorrow morning, and maybe contracting more to sort of the far southern coasts for Sunday and Monday, and then maybe pushing back up a little bit on Tuesday again against some of those windward coasts and ranges early next week. But we're not expecting too much with that. And as mentioned before, that cloud up in the north hanging around as we head into the weekend and early next week, and just a bit of a watch this space to see exactly where that moisture lines up from ex-tropical cyclone Megan. At this stage, looking like most of it will be staying across the territory and moving into Queensland, but yeah, fringing that top end of the state, could see a little bit around. And I guess the area of interest up there is because we have seen some of those floodwaters coming in from Queensland from previous storms and ex-tropical cyclone Kirrily. We do still have that flood warning out for inland rivers, water making it to Catatandy Lake Eyre. So maybe with some rainfall within the area or even just north in Queensland in there with those captions feeding some of that flow. So if people are travelling or just up in that area, just be mindful that we could see some renewed river rises, and expecting to see that flood warning persisting for quite a long time up through there. Other warnings around the state, really just got some marine warnings for today and the weekend as we head in there. Just a bit of enhancement with those winds along the coast with the sea breezes. So especially around the upper west coast, lower west coast, Spencer Gulf and Gulf St Vincent for this afternoon. Could see those winds pushing up to around 30 knots. And for tomorrow as well, those strong wind warnings for marine areas continuing for the upper west coast, lower west coast and Spencer Gulf. Again, those afternoon sea breezes possibly pushing up to around 30 knots through there. And then just having a look at some of the rainfall that we are expecting up until Tuesday, again with those light showers in the stream in the south, cumulative over those few days, less than really a couple of millimetres near those southern coasts. But up north, expecting to see some totals maybe of around 2 to 10 millimetres across the north of the state, and with some local heavier falls of maybe 10 to 30, and they'll be probably more likely in the far northeast there of the state there, Selena.
All right, thanks, Jenny. Have a great rest of your Friday.
No worries. Thank you, you and your listeners.
Jenny Horvath there from the Weather Bureau. Now looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow, the upper western district expecting a cloudy day with a high chance of showers in the northeast, medium chance elsewhere, chance of a thunderstorm. Light winds starting out, they'll be coming east to southeasterlies around 15 to 25 k's an hour in the morning. Overnight between 16 and 20 degrees, in the day between 22 and 27. For the lower western district, partly cloudy, there's a medium chance of showers in the northeast, most likely in the morning and afternoon, with near zero chance of rain elsewhere. There is a chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast. Winds will be south to southeasterly is around 15 to 25 k's an hour. Overnight temperatures in the lower western district down to around 13 to 17 degrees, and in the day they'll climb up to around 25 to 30 degrees. Coming up to 12:30 here on the South Australian Country Hour in this next half an hour, wild dogs in South Australia. What are the odds that many of them are in fact dingoes, and so should they be protected?
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Afternoon. How much do you know about the wild dingo population here in South Australia? Our state, we don't really have much of a dingo population, but farmers do have ongoing issues dealing with wild dogs that attack their stock. Well, coming up, you'll hear from a researcher who says that most wild dogs are in fact dingoes and she wants to see them better protected. Now, this all comes after a decision in Victoria this past week to stop wild dog culling in one part of their state along our border.
When you go out into the bush and you see an animal that looks like a dingo, it's likely to be a dingo, and it's unlikely to be a feral dog unless it really looks obviously like a dog. And that's important for people to understand when we're talking about managing the landscape and managing the animals and wildlife.
More on that coming shortly. Also today, how do you go about managing the need for more housing on the outskirts of our major cities and towns without gobbling up land that's needed to grow food for the growing population? Well, more on that as well. This is all After News Headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, Adelaide-based ASC and British defence giant BAE Systems have been announced as the main builders for the new SSN AUKUS submarines to be assembled in Adelaide. Australia will contribute almost $5 billion to the UK industry for design work and to expand production of nuclear reactors to be installed on the AUKUS subs. The first Australian-built submarine is scheduled to arrive in the early 2040s. Repair crews have been deployed to the Stuart Highway as sections of the crucial transport route remain cut by floodwaters. The road is closed 45 kilometres south of Tennant Creek, and the Prime Minister is yet to be drawn on a review of proposed religious discrimination laws. A major report from the Australian Law Reform Commission has recommended faith-based schools should no longer be allowed to discriminate against staff and students on the basis of their sexuality or gender identity. Some religious organisations have cautioned the government about making substantive changes to their hiring policies. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, last week, the Victorian government took the unprecedented step of banning wild dog control on public and private land in the northwest of that state. It means as of now, dingoes or wild dogs are not permitted to be culled on private or public land in the northwest of Victoria. The government says it's taken this step because dingoes are at risk of extinction. The dingo researcher, whose recent analysis played a key role in that decision, wants the laws to change also in South Australia. University of New South Wales research fellow Dr. Kylie Cairns was the lead author on a scientific paper released last year. She says the evidence continues to build that most wild dogs are in fact dingoes.
So we basically applied updated DNA testing technologies to the problem of distinguishing dingoes from domestic dogs and hybrids. The old method used about 23 different DNA markers, and we used 195,000 DNA markers. And when we used this method, we found that most of the wild dogs that we tested were actually dingoes that had no dog ancestry or had a small amount of dog ancestry. And we found very few animals that were either entirely domestic dog or were hybrids.
Right, and why is that distinction so important?
Because dingoes are a native animal in Australia, and so they should be conserved, and they're often not in Australia. Feral domestic dogs are a problem for many people, but that they do not appear to be forming self-sustaining populations in the bush. So when you go out into the bush and you see an animal that looks like a dingo, it's likely to be a dingo. And it's unlikely to be a feral dog unless it really looks obviously like a dog. And that's important for people to understand when we're talking about managing the landscape and managing the animals and wildlife in the land.
So the Victorian government's taken the step to ban any actions around wild dog and dingo control in the northwest of the state because of how critically low dingo numbers are, and that decision was largely based on your research. Is there any major difference with how populations are faring just across the border into South Australia, or is it a similar situation?
Yeah, so I know that there's very, very few dingoes south of the dingo fence in South Australia, and particularly in Narkat Conservation Area, which is basically the northwest Victorian population just on the other side of the fence in South Australia. There used to be a small dingo population, probably a similar size to the one that's in Victoria, but since about 2018, 2019 until now, there's been a change in policy, and they're actually baiting that area four times a year. And so we suspect that the population is really very low in South Australia and possibly even gone.
Right, so it might be too late, but you'd be suggesting, if not, to stop that practice now?
Yes, unfortunately, myself and many other conservation scientists have actually given advice to the South Australian government, I think last year, asking for them to change the policy, particularly about the dingoes in Narkat, recognising that they're an isolated population, there's very small numbers of animals, that there are pure dingoes without dog ancestry, and that, you know, they have inbreeding and genetic diversity issues. And the response was very disappointing, basically didn't change anything, and just got a response that they're going to keep trying to eradicate them, which is really concerning because native animals should be protected in national parks and conservation areas, and in this case that's not happening.
Well, what would you say to those that do want dingoes eradicated from the area because of the threat they pose to livestock or other farming practices?
Yeah, so around Narkat, there doesn't appear to be a huge reported problem with livestock loss. I think the livestock loss numbers reported are about 20 sheep or livestock maimed or killed a year. So it's not a massive problem in the area. Of course, that's going to cause issues for some farmers. But I recognise that with that level of livestock loss and the small dingo population, there are probably other tools that could be used to manage this for farmers, like what's going to be trialled in Victoria. So putting up electric fences, using livestock guardian animals, changing animal husbandry practices, i.e. putting cattle in the paddocks that are close to the park and putting sheep in internal paddocks away from the park, so therefore minimising the risk for sheep, whereas cattle are generally quite able to handle dingoes on their own. So it's not like there's no solution that's possible without baiting, and certainly baiting four times a year is going to be aiming to eradicate the population as opposed to minimising the population for livestock.
And are there any other places in South Australia where this is a concern for you as well, or is that the main area right now?
I think that there's very little information about how many dingoes persist south of the dingo fence. And I would say that it's concerning in terms of ecology for us to be removing the top predator from a whole part of the landscape, so anywhere south of the dingo fence, because that can have a lot of flow-on impacts on the ecology of the area. So, for example, you tend to get more large herbivores like kangaroos, which changes the vegetation profile of the landscape. It can often also mean that you have bigger impacts from invasive herbivores, as well as sometimes from invasive predators like foxes and cats.
Yeah, so how does South Australia compare to the other states when it comes to our practices then?
So there's a lot of baiting that goes on in a lot of states, particularly the ones that are south of the dingo fence. But I think it's really interesting that sort of stark divide in South Australia that doesn't really exist elsewhere, where if you are south of the fence, dingoes cannot be there. They are not going to be called dingoes. Their cultural value apparently just evaporates and their ecological value evaporates, and they're going to be killed. In fact, the aim in South Australia, south of the fence, is eradication. Not minimisation of livestock loss, but eradication. And that's a very different approach from other states. Even where they are doing really high levels of baiting, they are still not aiming to eradicate.
That is the University of New South Wales Research Fellow, Dr. Kylie Cairns. She was speaking there to Elsie Adamo. If you're listening in earlier on the show, today I spoke with Livestock SA. They've met with South Australian government officials this week. They're keen to look more into what this could mean for farmers with livestock along that section of the South Australian-Victorian border. That decision by Victoria last week to stop the cull of all wild dogs on private or public land in the northwest of Victoria. It is 21 minutes to one. Well, it's been a busy few weeks for the Minister for Primary Industries and Regions, Claire Scriven. She's just returned from China. Plus, there's been an announcement on funding for fire ants and the Kangaroo Island sterile blowfly
Blowfly Breeding Facility. Say that five times real fast. It's now open. Brooke Neindorf caught up with Minister Scriven earlier this morning to cover off on a few topics, starting with her trip to China.
So this trip was all about the wine industry. It was an incredibly useful trip. We had several events over there to promote South Australian wine. So Taste of South Australia event, a wine summit, and multiple meetings between importers, distributors and South Australian businesses. So it was really, really positive, a great vibe. Now, of course, while I was there, we had the announcement from the Chinese government of the interim decision about the wine tariffs, which, of course, has been caused such a difficult time for South Australian wine producers. So they have indicated that they no longer see a need for the tariffs, but that is an interim decision and we're expecting a final decision within the next week or two. Now, it is very positive. Obviously, we need to respect their process through to its completion, but it is very positive. And so the atmosphere in the events that we were holding were really positive. I also had a number of meetings with different provinces, including Shandong, which has a sister state relationship with South Australia, and a number of other people within government and within businesses, all about different things that we could do both for the wine industry, but also for things like educational exchanges and technical cooperation, all sorts of other things. So it was a very, very positive trip.
And so the talk around the tariffs, are those the buyers, the consumers, do they feel like they're going to be having Australian wines very soon?
Look, there certainly was a very, very strong sentiment in supporting South Australian wine, or Australian wine in general, but particularly South Australian wine. Every time we mentioned one particular brand, there was faces lit up, I must say. That was in the meetings with government officials as well. And so there is, I think, really still a very strong brand there. There's a lot of work to do, of course. We've been out of the market for several years now, and getting South Australian wine back onto the shelves, back onto the menus in restaurants and other establishments will all take some time. So we don't want to suggest that this is a silver bullet that's going to fix the wine over the play issue overnight. It's not, but it is a very important part of that solution, and some very, very positive steps have been made.
Minister, let's have a look now at fire ants. And the state government announced this week that they've committed an additional $17.1 million to the National Fire Ant Eradication Program to help with the fight against one of the world's most invasive pests. Now, this funding is in addition to some previous funding that we've put forward. Is that right?
That's right. So we spent $6.5 million previously as well, and this $17.1 million is part of a national commitment of $592 million over 4 years. So that's the amount from the federal, state and territory governments combined. So it is a large investment, but it's also a really large risk. Red imported fire ants are nasty, nasty creatures. Their bites can be fatal, particularly for children. And they can also really affect agricultural production. They can get into machinery and destroy machinery, cause ecological damage to the environment, sting not just people but livestock and pets as well. So it is a really, really nasty invasive species. Now, it's been in Queensland now for a number of years, but it's been moving very slowly because of the eradication efforts. Unfortunately, has been detected in northern New South Wales recently. So it's really important that this eradication program continues. And also that people are really aware that, you can't just bring in plants from another state, for example, without going through the necessary processes to ensure that they are not, you're not bringing a fire ant in unbeknownst to you, which could then threaten our whole way of life in many ways. We all love our outdoors. And fire ants could be a real inhibitor to that.
As you said, it hasn't been seen here in SA yet, but is there a risk that it could arrive in the state?
There is. When I was in Queensland last year, I actually visited the fire ant centre in Queensland and had a look at what they were doing and also the use of detector dogs in that area. And I think it was at that time that I was also told that a plant had made it to Victoria with one of the fire ants on it. Fortunately, it was detected. So it is unfortunately very easy for it to spread through things like soil and plant matter, which is why it's so important that people adhere to the requirements when they're bringing things like that in. Without that, separate to that, yes, they will continue to spread from the area where they are present in Queensland. So that's why we need to be doing all of these measures to make sure that we can slow that spread. It has been slowed over the last 10 years. But then make sure that it doesn't continue to expand its area.
I'm speaking with Minister for Primary Industries and Regions, Claire Scriven. Minister, in good news for Kangaroo Island and the eradication of the Australian sheep blowflies causing fly strike in sheep on Kangaroo Island is one step closer with the completion of the demountable sterile blowfly breeding facility. What happens from here now that that's been finished?
Yeah, look, it really is an exciting project. It's a $3.45 million building, and the pilot project was actually coming out of the Local Economic Recovery Program, which was jointly funded by the Commonwealth and state governments in response to the bushfires. So it's something positive that's come from that. So the building will be followed by a FADI-led $5.7 million research project funded by Meat and Livestock Australia, Australian Wool Innovation, Animal Health Australia and the SA Sheep Industry Fund and the University of Adelaide, so quite a few partners there. And it's going to allow 50 billion blowflies per week to be bred. They'll be rendered sterile before release, and then obviously when they mate, they won't be able to breed, which should make a huge difference to the amount of fly strike in sheep.
How long before the flies will be bred and ready to be released?
So the opening is expected to be in May, and then the first flies are expected to be released in September this year, and then the facility will increase to full capacity by next year.
What does this mean for farmers on Kangaroo Island?
Well, it's really a good news story because fly strike is a disease that affects the health of sheep and also impacts on wool, so that causes significant economic loss to farmers. So I saw a cost-benefit analysis reported that eradicating sheep blowfly on Kangaroo Island could save producers an estimated $88 million over the next 25 years, which is really, really fantastic. That's a significant amount, as well as, of course, improving animal wellbeing. So it's a very, very good outcome, and I'm looking forward to being able to get over there and officially see it in a short period of time.
Minister, we're covering quite a wide range of topics now. Let's go from blowflies to forestry now, and someone has been found to lead SA's Forestry Centre of Excellence.
That's right. So there are two really important roles. One of those has been filled, which is the role of General Manager, and Dr. Jim O'Hare has been appointed to that role. Now, Jim is an absolute legend. He was actually named as such at the Timber Industry Awards last year, if I remember correctly, as one of SA's Timber Legends, and he's going to be leading it as the General Manager. Now, in addition to that, there's a Director role, which has now started an international search for. So both very important roles, but it's wonderful to have Jim on board, Dr. Jim O'Hare. He is world-renowned in terms of his experience in forestry, wood production, environmental management, as well as other things. So very, very fortunate to have him on board, and the director role as well is now being advertised.
How has the Centre of Excellence been going?
Look, really well. You might recall that this is about really increasing our research capability. We've got a strong track record in research in forest industries here in South Australia. Tree Breeding Australia, for example, is part of that. And we're able to now really lock in our reputation because of the $15 million investment that we're making in the Forestry Centre for Excellence. So, continuing along this path, the appointments that we're talking about here are a really incredibly important part of that.
Minister, finally today, we've looked at a lot of positive stories for the state there and different primary industries, but we've been hearing a lot about wild dogs and dingoes this week and on the country today. Dr. Kylie Cairns, who's an academic who studies dingoes, has told the ABC that last year she, along with other academics, wrote to the SA government asking for changes to the wild dog management plan. Has this advice been acted upon yet, or why not?
Yeah, look, there is a research project that Dr. Kylie Cairns and some associates have done, and that's, one piece of academic research that will feed into the overall knowledge that we have around wild dogs. The advice that I had is that it didn't of itself indicate a need to change our approach. However, I have seen the Victorian government's decision from last Saturday I did write to the Victorian Government last year saying that we would like to be involved in giving feedback around this issue because, of course, anything that makes a change in Victoria, given we share a border, a very long border, can potentially have significant impacts on North Australia. So I'll be getting a full briefing from my department in the near future and perhaps we can talk about it again maybe next week or the week after.
So where to from here? That's speaking with the department and making a decision then, looking at this report?
Yes, so the advice that I had towards the end of last year was that there wasn't sufficient evidence to indicate that there was a need to change the South Australian policy. Now, we've, of course, invested large amounts of money in repairing the dog fence, $26.6 million in the dog fence rebuild project. And that's a really important part of protecting our livestock industry. In the last figures that I have, SA livestock producers lost 20,000 sheep per year to wild dogs. So it's important for that industry that we do continue to protect the livestock as much as possible. And then there's also, other impacts on farmers. You know, the psychological trauma of, finding large numbers of your sheep and lambs attacked and dying or dead is really hard, as well as the economic loss through through loss of lambs and so on. So it's a big issue. I'll be, as I say, getting some more detail from the department in a briefing in the next week or so.
We look forward to hearing more on the wild dogs once you do speak to the department on that topic, that issue. And, thanks for joining us on the program today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brooke Neindorf there, speaking with the Minister for Primary Industries and Regions, Claire Scriven, on a number of topics. But as you heard there at the end, this is an ongoing story we'll keep covering about the wild dogs. And if you would like to listen back, if you are one of our Metro listeners who didn't hear what Livestock SA had to say about this, you can always listen back to the South Australian Country Hour on our website. Go to abc.net.au/rural for lots of rural news, or just search for South Australian Country Hour. Or, of course, if you've got the ABC Listen app, that's very handy because you can go and find it all there. A few texts that have come in around this issue. This one reads, the researcher can go and help out during lambing on an affected property to see what it's like. Another similar text, this is, hopefully the researcher doesn't ever eat meat or use products made from wool. Mandy's in Seaton. Her text says, the South Australian Government has been very disappointing when it comes to our wildlife, etc. Mandy says, we have some of the weakest tree protection laws in Australia, which helps wildlife. I put in a submission as laws are under review, but very, very slow response, says Mandy. On a completely different topic, Sonia from Cowell has texted in to say, hi, Selena, what's the story with canned beetroot at the moment? Our little supermarket hasn't been able to restock either Edgell or Golden Circle for a month. Being rural and remote, we're always on the tail end of stock availability. But beetroot, really, asked Sonia. Floods, bad weather, can get a little fresh, but no cans. So, interestingly, earlier this month, the ABC did follow this one up, Sonia, so you can hop on that ABC Rural website. There's actually a story on there where you can read up everything that's happening with beetroot, abc.net.au/rural. But the short story is that our reliance on imports is being blamed for a national shortage of sliced beetroot, so you're certainly not alone. Apparently that's been going on for several months now. Not so much affecting fresh beetroot. You should still be able to get a hold of that, but canned is particularly being affected. Apparently American multinational Kraft bought Golden Circle back in 2008 and stopped canning beetroot at its Brisbane factory back in 2011. Apparently its production area in New Zealand in the Hawke's Bay area was wiped out in February last year due to Cyclone Gabrielle, caused flooding and landslips. So sliced beetroot has been affected for quite a while, but there is quite a story behind this. So I do recommend you hopping on and having a look, abc.net.au/rural. So at least on you, you are not alone or imagining things. Sliced beetroot in hard demand at the moment.
Muhammad.
The ABC presents a new drama series that takes you behind the walls of the sacred.
Baba, I should be your VP.
You put yourself above the almighty creator.
And into a story of family, love, secrets and betrayals at a Sydney mosque.
Love's not a bank loan, Asa. Never needs to be repaid.
The ABC's groundbreaking new drama, House of Gods. Sunday nights on ABC TV and streaming on ABC iView.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, governments across Australia are grappling with how to house our growing city populations while protecting vital peri-urban farmland. Dr. Rachel Carey is part of the University of Melbourne's Victorian Food Resilience Planning Project. She says more work is needed to strengthen protections for remaining farmland around Melbourne and regional cities. But she also wants the state and national food ministers appointed to tackle the critical issues of food cost and access.
There's a whole range of pressures on the food system, particularly around urban areas, in the sense that most of our populations live in urban areas. And so how it is that we feed people in urban areas becomes a significant issue that we need to look at in the future. And food systems are under pressure, of course, from climate change, from declining supplies of all the natural resources that underpin food production, including land, water, fertilisers, and of course, most importantly, the increasing number of people who are unable to gain access to sufficient, healthy and cultural appropriate food, primarily because they're unable to afford to do that. So the way forward here is to be developing integrated plans, integrated whole of government plans. So in Victoria, we should be developing an integrated food plan. We should have somebody within government who is clearly accountable for not just food supply, but whether Victorians have sufficient access to enough healthy and culturally appropriate food. So I would argue that we need a minister for food, for example, and that it should be clear what the accountabilities for that minister are. So it should be legislated with clear targets, and there should be monitoring against those targets, including loss of agricultural land, as well as how many people are currently food insecure.
Do you think we also need a food plan and a food minister at the federal level?
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. That should be mirrored at federal levels. The recent inquiry into food security in Australia did recommend that a national food plan is developed and that there should be also a minister for food. But I think the key thing here is that we're going to need to legislate so that it's clear what the accountabilities are of any minister for food and of other ministers that take actions that influence the food system and that influence food security as well. And we should be setting clear targets and monitoring against those targets. I think that's a really important thing here. It's not just about developing a plan. It's about ensuring that that plan is developed in an appropriate way. That means that our goals are clearly for not just an economically profitable food system, but one that is environmentally sustainable. And that also, of course, means that we produce food in a way that ensures that future generations can also meet their food needs, and that the food we're producing is healthy, and that it's also equitable, so that everybody has access to sufficient food. So we need to be looking at all of these things: the right to sufficient, adequate, healthy and culturally appropriate food is a basic fundamental human right, but it's not a human right currently that governments in Australia can be held accountable for, because it hasn't been legislated in Australia or at state level. And so it's really important that we start to see access to food as a fundamental human right, and that we actually legislate for that.
Dr. Rachel Carey from the Victorian Food Resilience Planning Project, speaking there with Fiona Broom. If you're interested about this topic, highly recommend hopping on that abc.net.au/rural website. Fiona's done a fantastic article there on this, and you'll learn more about agri-hoods, agricultural neighbourhoods where food production and housing are coming together, apparently already booming in the US, and Australia's first one is in the works. It's 2 minutes to one. Nikolai Balhart's be with you for afternoons. Hello, happy Friday.
Good afternoon, and to you.
What have you got for us to round out the week?
Well, you might have heard in the news over the course of this morning some new information that's been released by the Australian Recording Industry Association, ARIA, the ones that do the awards. It's really quite interesting. They're saying that the music industry has grown 11% over the past year, and that a lot of the money that's coming into the industry is coming through streaming.
Oh.
And I feel like every story I've heard about streaming is, you know, an artist gets a third of a cent for or less than,
that's,
you know,
thought, yeah,
for every stream. So we're going to speak with them this afternoon and find out, well, how does that kind of balance out with what the data that they've got? I mean, I wonder if it's includes the Taylor Swifts of the world, where they take up a lot of the streaming revenue, but what about Australian artists?
Yeah, she certainly earned her dollars out of me.
Absolutely. And we're also going to check in with a record store in Adelaide as well, because the other thing that's come through is, in terms of the physical sales, it's nearly all vinyl now.
Mm. When still, a tape's going to come back?
Just the hiss of a tape. That's what we've been missing.
And the whir of rewinding it and get the pen out.
That's right.
Oh, those were the days.
So we're taking a look at that this afternoon.
Fantastic. Should be a lot of fun. Nikolai Bauhartz will be with you for afternoons with that story and a lot more as well. Thanks so much for your company today and all this week. I'll be back next week. It's news time, 1 o'clock.
Lend us your ears and make life easier by using the ABC Listen app in the car. It will automatically quieten when you get calls or navigation instructions. Just make sure you favourite your local ABC radio station.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.